And good afternoon, and welcome to Financial Survival, a program of truth and honesty brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. We're on the web at dgscoins.com, or you can call us toll-free at 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter with the moniker at DGS Coins. One word, that's at DGS Coins. I'm Dave Allen, sitting in for Melody Cedarstrom, who's spending the day with family after the passing of a close relative. Let's remember to send our thoughts and prayers her way. Thank you for those thoughts. Also, Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs has the day off, but you can reach her by phone at 866-229-3663 or check her out at thepowerherbs.com. That's thepowerherbs.com. Wendy will be back with us next Wednesday. In today's first segment, I'll be bringing you some opinions and commentary on today's economic and political events. Then after the break, we'll hear a replay of Melody's excellent interview last Friday of James Corbett, which if you missed, you'll want to stay tuned in for. But first, let's go to the markets for a brief report. On the precious metals front, the price of spot gold is a little changed today. It was up early, gold and silver, particularly as the dollar paused in hopes of a U.S.-China trade deal. But then fell toward the end of the day. It's down about 4.25% or about 0.3% at 13.06. Silver's down about 0.8% at $15.55. Platinum also down about 0.6% at $7.86. And palladium's down about 0.7% at $13.94. Let's have a look at the paper markets. The S&P 500 up about 8.25% to 27.53. The Dow Jones Industrial Average up roughly 117 points, 0.5%, 25.542. And the NASDAQ up about 5.76 to close at 74.20. Also, preceding the U.S. markets were all the foreign markets that most of us follow. Again, all of them were up today. Again, largely, but not totally, on wishful thinking about a U.S.-China trade agreement. U.S. dollar index driving some of this movement today. Dollar rose on inflationary data, resumed its rally after a pullback on consumer prices, up about 0.45 to 97.16. Let's see, on the in the Treasury markets, all of the ones we follow were up slightly, relatively flat day. The bellwether 10-year yield up about 22 hundredths of a point to 2.7. The 2-year at 2.535, that's up about 3 basis points. And the 30-year Treasury still hanging slightly above 3 at 3.031. So let's see what's going on in the news. Speaking of trade, the trade agreement that U.S. negotiators are seeking reportedly will have some teeth in case China goes back on its trade promises as it has in the past. That's a top priority for Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin and U.S. Trade Rep Robert Lighthizer, who are holding talks this week with Vice Premier Liu He. The plan is to put in place an automatic tariff that would raise duties on Chinese goods if its exports to the U.S. keep rising. China has a controversial history of not living up to its trade obligations. You know, when China joined the WTO in 2001, it made a promise to allow foreigners to access its banking and telecom markets. However, to this day, it hasn't let any foreign company step in that respect. American negotiators want to make sure China will face some punishment if it continues this behavior. Now, the automatic mechanism isn't a new idea. It was actually put in place in 2001 when China joined the WTO, and President Obama used it in 2009 to impose tariffs on Chinese tire imports. But China retaliated with duties on cars and poultry, and the rule was let to expire in 2013. American negotiators now want to make China enforce its earlier promises and make a pledge on issues like protecting intellectual property and limiting government subsidies to exporters. The March 2 deadline for a trade deal is crucial in the negotiations, as U.S. tariffs on Chinese goods will increase if a deal is not struck by then. Interestingly, a development today, Chinese President Xi Jinping is scheduled to meet with Mnuchin and Lighthizer on Friday, as both sides pursue a deal before the deadline. Now, staying with the trade theme for another moment, a sharp divide between the Democrats and the president over how to enforce trade rules is threatening to delay or derail a congressional vote on a new NAFTA. Democrats want the administration to add provisions to last year's pact with Canada and Mexico that will ensure Mexico enforces environmental protections and allows its workers to form unions freely. Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, who's a Democrat, said, "Right now, the president's NAFTA update can't be enforced. No matter how good a deal looks on paper," he added, "it doesn't mean much if you can't make sure the other countries are living up to their end of the bargain." So, as the White House prepares for a potential fight to get its deal through Congress, an administration official said it was considering outsourcing lobbying efforts to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. That could be a powerful move. In the area of enforcement, most Democrats and Republicans in Congress want mechanisms in this and all trade agreements, really, designed to hold all partners to account through international arbitration panels or other means. But the Trump administration opposes ceding enforcement to such panels, believing Washington could face binding decisions that undermine U.S. sovereignty. The administration, however, does need the support of Democrats, particularly in the Senate, but the House as well. This draft deal with Canada and Mexico requires ratification in both the Senate and the House, as well as the legislatures in Canada and Mexico. Okay, let's move to Washington, I guess. You know, as we like to say these days, another day in our nation's capital, another drama. To be more specific, another week in Washington, another chaotic scramble to prevent another government shutdown. Yeah, with a little more than 2 days to spare before funding lapses for the second time since December, confusion reigned in D.C. today. Congress hurried to hash out text for the spending legislation as a few remaining snags reportedly delayed a final plan's release. News outlets say President Trump is expected to sign what lawmakers pass, even as the president and his administration stress that he'd like to see the legislation before backing it. Yesterday, the president said he was not happy with the agreement that he was briefed on by Senator Richard Shelby of Alabama, who's a member of the House and Senate Conference Committee that's working on this, but did not expect another shutdown, reportedly. Still, confusing rush to keep the government running does look like, it's going to persist in the coming days. About a quarter of the government shuts down if lawmakers fail to beat a midnight Friday deadline, or if the president decides to veto the legislation. Now, just briefly, the deal would provide about $1.375 $1.5 billion for 55 miles of new fence along the U.S.-Mexico border. It's about a quarter of the $5.7 billion and more than 200 miles of wall that the president most recently demanded. This morning, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders would not commit to the president signing the legislation. House Democratic Chair Hakeem Jeffries said he expects a House vote on the spending deal tomorrow and believes an overwhelming majority of the House Democrats will back the legislation. The spending legislation covers nine federal departments, so it leaves room for many continuing disagreements and potential provisions for all sides to dislike. So we'll see what happens. Things should become a lot clearer by tomorrow. Now, Wall Street bear Peter Buchvar warns that the current paper market rally is flawed and major setbacks will slam stocks. His chief reasons include sluggish global growth, the earnings slowdown, and a fuzzy economics picture. You know, he said, I would be fading this rally, thinking that it's more of a bear market bounce rather than this is the beginning of another bull market. He continued, the higher the market goes and the lower earnings estimates go, the more expensive the market is getting. Now, Buchvar was on the bear circuit in 2018, too. Last summer, he said U.S. stocks would get swept up in a wave of corrections. By October, his forecast began unfolding. And now he's telling his clients that a pullback retesting the December lows is a real threat. According to Buchvar, it's not unreasonable to worry about the earnings slowdown developing into a full-blown earnings recession. It's a risk, he said, because it's happening in the context of stalled monetary tightening. He also sees the Fed's decision to put its interest rate hike policy on hold as a bearish signal. At some point, he says, the market's going to ask itself, why is the Fed done raising interest rates? It's not because they've achieved their objective of getting around 3% growth. It's because the data, particularly overseas, caused them to take a step back. So, interesting perspective from the bear Buchvar. Now let's turn to debt in the remaining time of our segment here today. In a report issued actually this morning, U.S. PIRG, P-I-R-G, that's for Public Interest Research Group, warns that the continuing rise in auto debt is putting many consumers in a financially vulnerable position, which could worsen during an economic downturn. Kind of a Captain Obvious report, although does have some new information which is particularly relevant and critical to the debates going on in Washington and throughout the country, in my mind. The report comes on the heels of data released yesterday by the New York Fed that showed at least 7 million Americans were seriously delinquent on their car loan. That's 90 days or more days behind on the due date, and that was as of the end of 2018. And that 7 million figure is 1 million more than at the end of 2010. It shows that the total amount of auto debt that consumers carry, roughly $1.3 trillion, is 51% more than the amount owed at the end of 2009 when adjusted for inflation. Overall, auto debts account for about 9% of total U.S. consumer debt, and that's up from 6% in late 2011. Among subprime borrowers, that's those with credit scores below 620, the delinquency rate was 16.3% in 2018. Just 3 years earlier, that figure was 12.4%. So the overall growth in auto debt comes from consumers shifting preference for larger, more expensive vehicles, such as trucks and SUVs instead of sedans or compact cars. The average price of a new vehicle, as we reported 2 weeks ago, is now over $37,000. That's compared with $27,500, roughly, just 5 years ago. For consumers, that means higher balances and loans that stretch longer. As of January, the average amount financed on an auto was over $31,000. And the average loan length, 69 months. That's up from 61 months. And at the same time, the national debt surpassed $22 trillion for the first time yesterday, a milestone that experts warned is further proof the country's on an unsustainable financial path that could jeopardize the economic security of every American. The debt has been rising at a faster rate following passage of the $1.5 trillion tax cut package a little more than a year ago, followed by bipartisan congressional efforts to increase spending on domestic and military programs. The nation has added more than $1 trillion in debt in the last 11 months alone. Reaching this unfortunate milestone is so rapidly is the latest sign that our fiscal situation is not only unsustainable, but accelerating. That's Michael Peterson, who's CEO of the Peterson Foundation, a nonpartisan organization working to address the country's long-term fiscal challenges. For Americans, as we talk about a lot here in Financial Survival, the growing debt should be a big concern, because over time it can push up interest rates for consumers and businesses and crowd out other investments. The higher rates ripple through the economy, nudging up mortgage rates, corporate bonds, and other type of consumer business loans. And a big national debt also makes it harder for the government to increase spending to combat the next recession or devote more money to retraining workers and helping the poor, among other programs. It's an interesting report. Let's see. I think that's all we have to say about that. There was a comment made by former Senator Judd Gregg and former Governor of PA Ed Rendell, who chaired the nonpartisan campaign to fix the debt. They said the debt eclipsing $22 trillion is, quote, another sad reminder of the inexcusable tab our nation's leaders continues to run up and will leave for the next generation. Gregg, if you didn't know, is a former Republican senator, and Rendell, a Democrat. Let's see, in the remaining minute or so we have left, where do we want to go? There's a lot here still to report. I'm sure Melody will talk about most of it tomorrow. Another wave of store closures is expected to hit shopping centers and malls this year, with no light at the end of the tunnel, according to a new research report. Retailers have already announced almost 2,200 new store closures since the beginning of this year. Gymboree, Penny's, Charlotte Russe, and Ann Taylor. That's up 23%. Oh, boy. Well, you know, let's take a short break. Melody's interview of James Corbett will be back played after a few short messages. I'm Dave Allen. Have a good one.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Financial Survival brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. And I'm pleased to welcome back to the program James Corbett. And of course, you know, James is the founder and editor of the Corbett Report. And you can go to that website, thecorbettreport.com. And James also became the editorial writer for the International Forecaster that was created by economic analyst Bob Chapman. And of course, if you would like a complimentary issue of the International Forecaster, please go to their website, theinternationalforecaster.com. And hello, James.
Well, hello. Thank you for having me back on. It's a pleasure to be here again.
Oh, it's I love this hour. I love this hour with you. And I have a simple question. What's new?
Good question. All right. Well, I'll give you a multiple choice answer if you want.
Okay.
Okay. So, one of the multiple choice answers is that contrary to all of my inclinations to dismiss and ignore to the extent possible the political back and forth caterwauling nonsense that populates the news feed like so much excess dryer lint, I actually paid attention enough to the headlines about the State of the Union address by the president to actually pick up on something from that speech that I'm going to be writing about in the International Forecaster this weekend. So that would be one of the options.
Are you going to give us a little bit of a hint?
Well, if you want to go straight into that one, we can go into that.
Okay, well, what's your number two?
Number two, I'm going in the near future, I'm going to be talking about the crisis of science, including replication, irreproducibility of reports, which is a word that I think I'm going to have to practice between now and the time I actually record the report, and other things that are calling into question the scientism, which unfortunately has affected the population in recent decades. Experts say, scientists warn, etc., etc. And the third possibility for what's new would be reports about China and its ongoing police state high-tech crime-fighting crackdown, including its AI, what's touted as an AI-powered crime-fighting system like Skynet and other such things, like literally called Skynet. I'm not making a Terminator reference. That is apparently being not utilized to its full, is being turned off because it may be a little too effective in catching some of the crooks in Chinese government. So those are your one, two, three options. You tell me which one you pick.
Well, I did have some questions about the Chinese dragon that you recently wrote about. So we'll skip that one. And now I have a choice between the state and the... Let's start with the crisis of science. That intrigued me.
All right. Well, this is not... It's not exactly fringe thinking at this point to be criticizing the ivory towers of academic science. In fact, it has been picked up on quite a lot in the last several years. And you've seen headlines on it in the Washington Post, in The Economist, and the Times Higher Education Supplement, and Scientific American, and Nature, and Phys.org, and many other sites are talking about various problems in mainstream science, which were perhaps most notably flagged for the first, or not for the first time, but notably flagged in 2005 by a researcher. I don't want to get his name, the name pronunciation of his name wrong, but I will anyways. John Ioannidis, who published an article in PLOS, which is one of the major science publication repositories, called "Why Most Published Research Findings Are False," in which he had the rather startling but undeniable fact that a lot of scientific material that is published is not reproducible and is in fact false. Now, this has been something that's been talked about and explored in various facets. It was essentially a critique of psychology and psychological studies, but this has since branched out. They've found these types of errors and biases and problems going on in economics and in medicine, in nutrition, all of these different fields of science where there are some serious problems, and people are starting to identify some of the key structural issues that lead to the startling fact that 70% of researchers, according to Nature.com, had tried and failed to reproduce published experiments, and also showed that 40% of those researchers believed that fraud was always or often the inability to reproduce research. So there's scientists are basically blowing the whistle saying there's a lot of fraud going on. And why is that? Why is it happening? There are obviously incentives in place. When we see behavior like that happening, there are incentives in place to motivate people to act in that way. And there are a number of them that, again, are structural issues to the way that science is conducted right now. And one that I'm sure a lot of people have heard about, at least mentioned, is publish or perish. You have to publish papers in reputable journals and receive so many citations in order to essentially keep your cushy research jobs and keep the grant money flowing into your lab. And that has created a situation where people will do increasingly anything to get their studies published. And there's a lot of different ways that you can do that. Of course, the way to get a study published, to ensure that a study will get published, is to have a sensational or remarkable finding. Now, of course, breakthrough findings in science don't exactly come along every day. So how do all these people vie and how do they wrangle and try to get their studies to show something surprising enough to get some attention, at least to show something surprising enough that the journal will be willing to publish it? And hey, if it also generates lots of headline articles in the mainstream media, then that will generate a lot of attention to your research, so much the better. Universities and labs love that, because then it'll get them more attention. So that's another aim. How do they go about doing this? There are a lot of different ways. One that's been talked about in recent years is p-hacking, which probably means nothing to everyday layman, but is a type of statistical trick, essentially, to try to show something of statistical significance that may actually be completely irrelevant. So, I mean, there are any number of examples of how this is done and what kinds of things result from it, but one that I think most people can relate to is trying to follow nutritional guidance or nutritional advice, at least such that trickles down through the media. I mean, take, for example, coffee. You have undoubtedly heard it increases your chance of urinary tract cancer, or it decreases your chance of stroke, or, you know, take chocolate. Eating chocolate can make you live longer. Eating chocolate is terrible for your heart. Eating chocolate, no matter what it is, you have heard contradictory results in the span of your lifetime, I guarantee it, on all sorts of different foods. And that's one way that we see this playing out in the everyday media. But I think the most insidious part of this problem, what it really boils down to, is, yes, it is about, essentially, I mean, these are people who are scientists that are trying to make their way in a career, and they're trying to get, obviously, prestige, but perhaps more importantly, grant money so that they can continue doing research. Where is that money coming from? Increasingly, that money is coming from the corporations that are dictating the ways in which this money is dispersed and what it will be spent looking into, and thus what the results of that research will be. And I talked about this recently on my program, where I was talking about Johnson & Johnson and their baby powder asbestos scandal, as reported on by Reuters last December, yes. Where they were talking about this problem that Johnson & Johnson have known about since the 1950s at this point, some of their key sources of baby powder were mixed in, the talcum was mixed in with asbestos, and they knew this internally, corporate-wise, and they were trying to look at ways to downplay this or distract people from it. And one of the things I talked about in that story was the Johnson & Johnson head researcher of their research department anonymously publishing and then reviewing a study about how, oh, it's no big deal. You see, the cancer rates are about the same in this control group as in that one, which was, of course, the whole point of the study. That's why Johnson & Johnson was doing this and trying to anonymously publish these studies and then cite them elsewhere. That's an example of how corporations can influence research, but there are many, many other examples possible. And then what's the alternative? Well, of course, the government can provide money, but, of course, that just leads to the creation of institutions like the Climate Research Unit at the University of East Anglia in England, which has been responsible for a lot of the climate change, you're killing the environment with your SUV kind of propaganda that we've seen over the last several years or decades at this point, and was infamously exposed during ClimateGate, where the internal emails of the CRU team came out, and lo and behold, it showed them fixing and fudging numbers and organizing amongst themselves to try to keep certain papers from being published and things like this, things that were didn't go along with the climate change alarmism. It was a huge scandal that ultimately got swept under the rug because of some whitewash commissions that were appointed to sweep it under the rug. But it's you can go and read in black and white the researchers' own emails and what they were doing, of course, in order to keep that money flowing. And that's one of the things that this boils down to. We've been fed this idea that scientists are floating around on clouds and are so much above all of this, but essentially they are playing. They're playing games that have been set up for them, and of course reveling in their sort of saint-like status in the scientistic society, where scientists are revered. Oh, these are the people who will tell us what's what about reality, and they have no biases, of which, of course, again, as we're finding out more and more, is absolutely 180 degrees from reality.
So the world in which we live is just, you know, it's really amazing, because people make decisions, their life decisions, on a lot of this information and things that are fed them, and you know, it's there's no accountability, and everybody knows this. Everybody accepts that there's 40% fraud, and yet what is ever being done? Because the money overpowers the need to hold anybody accountable.
Exactly right. And there are some ideas that are coming along that at least promise to be, to open up the doors a little bit more, to allow the public sort of to see what's going on under the hood a little bit more, hopefully, which include the entire concept of open science, because as people may or may not know, the primary outlet for publication of respectable scientific research, of course, is through these publishers that publish these journals that are heavily gatekept for certain, you know, scientific dogma that must be adhered to and all of this, and it forms these cliques like what was exposed in ClimateGate. Well, the idea that, well, hey, we are living in the internet age, we can have a different way of doing this now. Now, instead of going through these publishers that then send out these papers to different reviewers to get their comments and then work the paper into some publishable form, da-da-da, well, in this day and age, it is certainly possible, and some people are trying out this concept of putting out preliminary research in ways that is open to comment, and not just open to comment within a certain closed clique of the scientific community that is allowed to, but really open to comment so that anyone, even a layman who was sufficiently interested and motivated, could provide feedback and criticism and point out flaws in the research and what's going on, so that it could take some form of shape or form that would be perhaps more responsive to reality, shall we say, and more responsive to criticism or charges of fraud. That's one example of the ways that the communication technology itself could change the way that we conceptualize what is the way that science is gatekept in our current day and age. And there are other ideas too, like a much simpler idea perhaps is the idea that, well, if people are motivated to publish because they must publish, then people may try to replicate a study. But why would they? Why would they try to replicate someone else's research? You're not going to publish your own journal study article saying, hey, look, I successfully published this research, or even if you don't successfully replicate this research, even if you don't successfully replicate it, again, that's not going to get you your scientific name and fortune. So people are saying, well, maybe we should have journals of reproducibility. I was able to reproduce, or I was not able to reproduce this result. And that in itself could form a sort of incentive for people to actually try to replicate research, which is the theory upon which this is all working. Oh, you know, don't worry. Once a study has been published in Nature or whatever, don't worry. I'm sure, I mean, it could be replicated anytime, anywhere by anyone, and they'd find the same results because this is ironclad research. Well, no, they're going back and finding, you know, actually as much as half or even more of papers can't be reproduced, and you can't find the same results. So there's clearly a gaping problem in the system. Perhaps if we motivate people to try to reproduce results and find some way to incentivize that, that could be one way of putting in another check in the system.
So what you're saying is we should just ignore most any reports that come out by science.
We should certainly ignore the sensational, grabby headlines in the media, which are motivated by their own corporate slant for corporate advertising and what have you. And it's an insidious system that occasionally will get exposed, but generally decades too late. As people might have seen in the last few years, it came out, surprise, surprise, who would have thunk it, when the American... Oh, I don't know which. I don't know which particular branch of government it was that came out in 1980 with the dietary guidelines, you know, the food pyramid and all that. That was, of course, heavily influenced by various industries, nutritional industries that wanted you to essentially consume more sugar. And so they pumped this, oh, low-fat diet, so we got to take fat out. Well, you've either got fats, carbs, or proteins to play with, and protein energy content is about going to remain the same. So if you're reducing fat, you're going to have to increase carbs. And if you increase carbs, what's the easiest way to do that? Well, sugar. So, hey, great. It's great for the sugar industry and people who rely on it, like the soda companies and all of that. And now it turns out, oh, now they're coming out and saying, oh, you know what, that was completely a wrong turn, perhaps one of the worst turns in the history of medical science. We shouldn't have said that. In fact, you know, fat isn't an unmitigated evil, and in fact, carbs and sugar itself may in fact be a toxin, which we should try to avoid more. Oops, you know, sorry about that. And it's finally starting to come out, but along with that, a lot of the stories about how the sugar industry, essentially, and as I say, the associated industries, basically kept this under wraps for decades, even though they knew that this was causing the obesity epidemic that we've seen skyrocket since that food pyramid was introduced.
Yeah, it really is incredible. And again, the Overwatch. And how much of the internet? We're going to be heading into a break here shortly. How much is the internet that has that since 2000? You know, really since the year 2000, the increase of usage of the internet and people following these headlines and so forth. That has had to have some kind of a major impact.
It certainly has, and we can follow up on that after the break.
Okay, and we're heading into this break right now. We'll be right back. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Financial Survival. We'll be right back right after this short message.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today. today, complete with two Black Berkey elements for only $231. And the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with my guest, James Corbett of the Corbett Report. Please make sure you visit the website, thecorbettreport.com. And heading into the break, we were talking about the Internet and the impact that it has on these false scientific studies and how it has perhaps have made those studies grow over the years since the Internet has basically come into every home.
Yeah. Well, it's I think there's huge changes taking place in every facet of society because of these technological changes, and science is no different. And there's actually a really specific example with the thread that we could follow of someone who was heralded as this great matron saint of climate change researchers, Judith Curry, and she was working, I believe, at the University of Georgia. I don't remember which university at this point, but she was heralded as an expert on hurricanes and how extreme weather events might be affected by climate change, and she was highly cited until around the time of the ClimateGate scandal. She started a blog to basically go over issues and thoughts that she was having. So it's called Climate Etc., judithcurry.com. And she started to say, well, you know, some of these critics about what was happening at the Climate Research Unit and what's going on with this ClimateGate scandal, some of these critics have a point, and, you know, maybe we should listen to some of these ideas. And immediately the backlash started. Suddenly, Judith Curry, who had been hailed as this great researcher, was suddenly literally called a climate heretic and basically hounded because she just talked about not towing the line with regards to the dogma of the climate change hysterics. And as a result, over the last several years, her blog has become a valuable place for I don't want to say contrarianism, because that isn't it, but just alternative voices within the climate world, including, and we could point to a very specific example. Last October, there was this story about the oceans are heating up faster than expected because of new calculations. This new study that was published in Nature found that oceans were taking up 60% more heat than originally thought. That means that the Earth is actually warmer than we thought, and it's warming up quicker than we thought, and basically we're going to hell in a handbasket a lot sooner than we thought, and we have less time to save the world than we thought we did. It was this big scaremongering couple of weeks of this nonstop propaganda in all the usual outlets, CNN and Washington Post and what have you. And then on Judith Curry's blog, there was a researcher who had been invited to look at this new paper because he had some familiarity with the area, and he noticed on page one a basic mathematical error in this, again, published in Nature, the prestige journal. You know, you can't get higher than that in the scientific world. On page one, a basic mathematical error that completely threw their conclusion completely out the window. The study was essentially useless because they had made a basic error. And he pointed this out on Judith Curry's blog to the point where the researchers had to go and say, oh, you know, sorry, Nature, but it looks like there's a mistake. And yeah, it means our study's useless. So, amazingly, you can still go and get that study at nature.com. They didn't even retract it. They just put a little editor's note on it to say the researchers have informed us that there is an error that makes these conclusions untenable, blah, blah, blah. We'll assess the effect this has and update in the future, something along those lines. So they haven't retracted the paper. They haven't provided any updates, but basically, the study is bunk. All of those headlines that went out about how the oceans are heating faster and it's worse than we thought and all this, of course, you know, everyone saw those headlines. No one saw the little correction that was that came out weeks later. And what was the BBC version of this? Climate change concerns over report on ocean heating. was the headline they went with. Whereas, of course, you know, 60% hotter oceans, the oceans are boiling, all of these scaremongering headlines. But when they come to issue the retraction, it's buried in the bottom of the science news feed on, you know, page 17 of the website, and it comes with this little concerns over report on ocean heating nonsense headline that tells you nothing about this basic mathematical error that completely changes the entire study.
Huh. It truly is amazing, isn't it? And no one's there to, and people don't look, people don't do their own reading, they just read headlines.
So I don't know if that's a hopeful story or not, because, hey, at least, you know, because of the internet and this open nature and this blog that publishes these things, this error was spotted and found and detected, but then, how does that get propagated out to the media, and how do people consume that? Well, most people won't see that retraction. Most people will see the original headline, so is it a boon or not? I don't know.
Well, let's go into the topic of the State of the Union. We've just had that this week with President Trump, and certainly the media, and they've certainly have dragged that around enough times. So you caught something that you wanted to talk about.
Yes, yes. Well, I did pick up, obviously, on the headlines in the MAGA, you know, Donald Trump is the savior kind of press that said, oh, you know, look, you know, Trump is saying that America will never be a socialist country and all of this great rhetoric. Isn't this great? Well, you dig into the speech, and of course, it's all the usual stuff about, oh, we need to go in and overthrow Maduro because he's an evil dictator, and we, the policemen of the world, get to tell people how to run their countries and blah, 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 that kind of stuff. Or, you know, we have to support Israel, so we have to get rid of Iran because they're the evil boogeyman, and that kind of stuff. And, oh, yeah, he says, you know, we will never be a socialist country. But the problem with that little theory is that America is a socialist country. It already is. To be fair, every country is to some extent or other, because they all operate under this principle that there is a single central authority that gets to, at the very basic level, literally run the economy, because they literally print the money. They're monopoly capitalist control over the money. Monopoly capitalism, state capitalism, is socialism. That's what it is. It's control by a central crew. And basically, we're being offered national socialism versus international socialism, but people who want genuinely free markets and free from government intervention aren't ever going to see that in their lifetime unless there is a dramatic change in events and people stop accepting and swallowing this Kool-Aid from politicians who tell them, you know, we'll never be a socialist country. Meanwhile, the EPA is dictating what you can or cannot do with your business, and the FDA is dictating what you can or what drugs you can or cannot take, or what food you can put into your body, and every other, I mean, go through the list. The SEC is telling people, you know, how to run their businesses, even as they know about gaping backdoors in the software that they mandate for companies to use for their compliance, and I mean, you can go through the list, blah, 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 but yes, it is a socialist system. It is set up by a clique that essentially controls and regulates every aspect of the economy, everything that's going on. Yeah. That is socialism. So saying America will never be a socialist country and all these people standing up and applauding, yay, yay, you know, we'll never be a socialist, you already are. People realize that and realize what that means, they'll continue to swallow the Kool-Aid from politician after politician. And the next, whatever the next crusader and savior, political savior that comes along, they'll get behind as well. And until they stop and really realize what state capitalism is socialism.
Well, you're right. Something drastic is going to happen, and then even then, so I'm not quite sure they'd even recognize, you know, where we're exactly at. But, you know, one thing that I noticed in the State of the Union was he made a statement that he is meeting with North Korea, Kim Jong-un, on February 27th and 28th in Vietnam. Now, shortly thereafter, the next day, I saw there was a Michael Cohen, President Trump's so-called fixer, was originally scheduled to testify publicly in D.C., and then they changed it to a private testimony for, I think it was like February 12th, and now they changed that also February 28th at the same time that President Trump is meeting with the North Korean leader in Vietnam. Now, I know that might be just a coincidence, but, you know, I just can't leave it at that. Do you think there's, you know,
yeah.
Does it mean anything, or is it
I don't want to misattribute this quote. I believe, I want to say it was FDR. Oh, I don't remember. But whoever it was, former president, said there are no coincidences in politics, or something to that effect. And, you know, for once, I think the president was right about something. Yes, there are no coincidences when it comes to these things. And it's, of course, if you are trying to undermine a president politically, and again, I'm not taking sides in this kind of stuff. It's just political distraction, you know, put out this puppet and make the public hate him or make the public love him. Either way, it's you're still looking at a puppet show. But yes, within that system where, of course, you have the Dems and the Republicans, you know, arguing and bickering, of course, if you're trying to undermine the president politically, if there's a chance that he's going to get some kind of great photo op that'll look good and make him into a leader, well, then you do something on that same day that'll take the news coverage away from that. And, you know, it's not exactly rocket science.
Or could it be the other way around, is to take away the testimony of Michael Cohen because he goes to prison shortly thereafter.
Well, there you go. I mean, actually, yes. I don't know. Yeah, that's a good point. I don't know which date was set first. Yeah, so whatever way it is, it's, yeah, political puppeteering.
Abortion has been in our news lately, and I'm curious, what does the world, what does Japan and the world, how do they view abortion? I mean, is it as...
Well, that's a pretty broad topic. How does every human being on the planet...
I mean, is it... Well, let's just take Japan.
Yeah. That, you know, what are the actual laws? That's a very good question. When I think of this as a political issue, I think most recently about Ireland, which in the last couple of years, of course, have had the big vote to basically approve abortion under certain circumstances in Ireland, which was a pretty big move for a staunchly Catholic country that had for very long opposed this practice. So that was a pretty big move. But again, it is country by country. But when we're talking about what is it, third trimester, late third trimester, up to the point of dilation, maybe even actually delivering the baby and then having talks with the mother about whether or not it should be killed. That's, I mean, I don't think there's anyone alive who thinks that's a great idea that we definitely need. It's, there's an awful lot of controversy that surrounds it. But as crazy as that sounds, it's actually even worse because it was just a few years ago that people will always say, oh, you know, the slippery slope argument is nonsense and, oh, it's not like people are arguing for infanticide. Well, of course, a few years ago, they did have I can't remember which person was, but a large name in the field of bioethics, whatever that means, but who came out with a article about essentially infanticide, you know, post-delivery abortion, something along those lines. It may be feasible or it might be advisable that we should start thinking about within the first 2 years of life before, you know, the baby really develops into a thinking human being, that maybe the mother should be allowed the option to continue to terminate the life, whatever they want to call it. It's murder, of course, at that point, but that is the argument that is now starting to be broached in the bioethics journals and elsewhere, and this is the way they introduce it to the public. Well, you know, we have late third trimester abortions that might involve a delivery. We might have to commit the abortion after the delivery, which, of course, again, is just flat-out murder, but it's trying to change the rhetoric around this issue and soften the public, essentially, to be ready when these ideas start to be floated by the technocrats in power.
Is the U.S. leading the way?
It looks like it at this point. Certainly this type of... I haven't seen this type of discussion being discussed elsewhere, but, But then again, I mean, you think of, you know, the forced abortions and what have you in China, so, the technocrats perhaps vie with each other for who can be the most evil in their practices.
Amazing. We wanted to get to your most recent article, Fake News and Economics Edition.
Yes.
And we have about 2 minutes.
Okay. Well, I mean, this stems from the news that came out in the past couple of weeks about Japan and is now going through its economic data and finding that 40% of the economic data that's issued by or relied on by the government for its various unemployment benefits and things like that, 40% of its economic data is bogus. Specifically, 22 of the 56 key economic stats reported by the government are faulty and that, quote, irregularities in 21 of the 22 sets amounts to violations of the statistics law. So this is a big scandal, and now it's becoming a political scandal, and they're basically, the opposition is saying this undermines the government's credibility and all of this. La-di-da. Well, yes, this is a scandal, but only because people aren't really aware of just how commonplace it is. In fact, every country on the planet cooks its books in one way or another, or does statistical fudgery to make things sound better when they need the public to be on their side. And China is a glaring example of that with its GDP fudgery and various examples that have come out in recent years. The governor of one of the provinces in China coming out and admitting that they made up economic data basically to receive bureaucratic handouts because they, you know, it's performance based. So if your province is doing better, you'll get more handouts. Well, of course, we're going to make up the numbers. So they've come out and admitted that. There's a fake inflation data scandal that took place in Argentina in recent years. Fake economic data is in the news in India. There was that big scandal about Greece faking its way into the Eurozone with the help from Goldman Sachs a few years ago. Mm-hmm. But I use this basically as a way of introducing the reader to, who might not know about it, to the extraordinary new federal guidelines that the U.S. government introduced or is now operating on, and that were outlined in October of last year. Now the government is legally allowed to lie to the American public about their budgets in the name of national security. You have to read this story to get the full ramifications of that.
Oh, in America, here we go. All right, I appreciate it. They've been doing it for such a long time now. It's legal to do.
Now it's black and white. Yep. Crazy.
And thank you, James, for joining us today. And I want to thank the listeners for joining us. And we'll be back. And be safe. Good night. And God bless. I have a friend. If I could be.